Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, now we continue with the discussion of the Mahatanha-Sankhaya Sutta. This is the greater discourse on the destruction of craving, Sutta number 38 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And we are, let's see. Okay, we're on page 358. This is section 26. And we come to the section on the round of existence, which speaks about how the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. And now, in my understanding, the reason why the Buddha begins this particular section of the sutta is to present what I would say in concrete terms, even in biological terms, okay, or to present a concrete biological example or exemplification of the terms of the formula of dependent origination. So far he's given the formula of dependent origination in somewhat abstract terms. You know, we just have these terms with ignorance as condition, there are volitional formations, with volitional formations as condition, consciousness, through consciousness, name and form, one condition after another like that. But the terms of the formula have not been explained or clarified in any way. Okay, and now we're going to see from one point of view in what way the terms, these terms of the formula can be exemplified. And I don't think this is the only way in which they can be exemplified, but this is one particular way in which we can, what I would call a biological or maybe an organic exemplification of the terms. That is, the way these terms can be seen as exemplified through the unfolding of the life process. And so first we have the descent of the embryo taking place through the presence of these three factors, that is the union of the mother and father, that is sexual union of mother and father. Then the mother has to be in season, she has to be fertile. And then there has to be this condition called the Gandhabha present. And last week I explained through some examples my understanding that what is meant by the Gandhabha is this being who is ready to take rebirth, this kind of spirit or a being in this, what is sometimes called the intermediate state, that is a being who is detached from its previous mode of existence, who is seeking the conditions for a new rebirth, and who is karmically, has some kind of karmic affinity with the mother and father or with rebirth through this mother and father. And so when all of these conditions come together, then there is the descent of the embryo. Or we could say it's the actually the arising of an embryo takes place in the mother's womb. And in another discourse of the Buddha, this is the great discourse on causation, the Mahanidana Sutta, what is here called the descent of the embryo is called the descent of consciousness. Here in this sutta, the Buddha speaks about consciousness descending into the mother's womb. And so when we speak about the Gandhaba being present, we should understand that the Gandhaba, this being to be born, it's probably, I would consider it to be a combination of five aggregates. But the rupakanda, the form aggregate, would be a very subtle type of material form, so that ordinarily it will not be visible to human eyes, except for those maybe people who have developed the divine eye or some kind of shentong, some kind of superior faculty of vision. But normal people won't see it, though it's said sometimes that dogs will bark at it. Okay, and when the Gandhaba is present, and then there's the union of the mother and father, then that Gandhaba loses its consciousness, or loses awareness, and it descends into the womb, and then the mother becomes pregnant. And that is the descent of the embryo. And in terms of the normal form, the usual formula of dependent origination, what is happening here, we could say, is that the Gandhaba will represent a being coming from the past, bringing over the ignorance, volitional formations, and consciousness from the past. Descending into the womb, that would represent the consciousness coming, descending into the new life, and also that first moment of consciousness arising in the new life. And then the occurrence of conception, the occurrence of conception will mean the arising of name and form together with the arising of consciousness in the new existence. So when conception takes place, what happens is that consciousness arises, the first moment of consciousness, and along with consciousness comes nama-rupa, name and form. And that is explained here. This arising of name and form can be seen as the descent of the embryo that takes place. Okay, then the Buddha describes here the development of the embryo. The mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood. for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the Noble One's discipline. Okay, so this development of the embryo in the mother's womb is the development of name and form. And technically, as the embryo develops in the womb, then the six sense faculties are taking shape during that period. But the faculties have not yet really started to interact with the world. Okay, but it is when the child comes out from the womb that now the faculties are starting to interact with the world. Okay, so now the child grows up and his faculties mature, and the child starts playing at games. These are games that they played in India. I don't know, some of them, maybe they still have today. Not so different from the games children play today. Except now they have electronic versions. Okay, so now when the child grows up, he's provided and endowed with the five chords of sensual pleasure, form, sounds, smells, taste, tactile objects that are enjoyable, pleasant, agreeable, and so on. Okay, so now all of this really signifies the six sense faculties now making contact with their objects. And now the next passage is going to show how from this contact of the senses with their objects, one starts creating new conditions that will create a new round of bondage, or a new stage of bondage, continuing the round of existence. Okay, so seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it, or he desires it, craves for it, if it is pleasant. And he dislikes it if it is unpleasant, unpleasing. Then he abides with mindfulness not established, mindfulness of the body not established, with a limited mind, and does not understand as it truly is the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, where these evil, unwholesome states, that is the states of craving and aversion, where they cease without remainder. Okay, engaged as he is in the expression used here is favoring and opposing. Or in Pali it's anuroda, viroda, which actually means liking and disliking. Whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling. That is, he delights usually in the painful feeling. He delights in the pleasant feeling. He welcomes it and remains holding to it. That is the usual pattern. One delights in the pleasant feeling and clings to the pleasant feeling. But what happens when one experiences painful feeling? Usually one doesn't delight in painful feeling. Unless, well, some people might, but it's not typical. But if one experiences a painful feeling, then one turns away from it and one seeks some other pleasant feeling as a kind of escape from it. And then one delights in that other pleasant feeling as an escape route from that painful feeling. And then when one experiences the neutral feeling, feeling that's not painful or pleasant, if it's a kind of peaceful feeling, then one will take a kind of subtle delight in that feeling. But if it's a really dull, boring type of neutral feeling, then one becomes bored with it and one seeks some kind of exciting, pleasant feeling as an escape from that dull boredom. So in this way, no matter what kind of feeling one experiences, pleasant, painful, or neutral feeling, either directly or indirectly, that feeling will trigger off some kind of delight or craving. Okay, so one is seeking delight in feeling. And as one is seeking delight in feeling, then delight arises in him. And this delight in feeling, this is what the Buddha calls clinging. Okay, so we have first, one takes delight in feeling. Okay, this taking delight in feelings, this is clinging. Okay, so we have here several of the stages in the series of dependent origination. Okay, first, one experiences these feelings. Okay, that is Vedana, or feeling. Okay, then whatever feeling one experiences, then one delights in that feeling, welcomes it and remains. Actually, first one delights in that feeling and welcomes it. That much, we could say, represents the craving. One is delighting in that feeling and welcoming it. That's like the first stage of responding to the feeling. Then after welcoming the feeling, then one remains holding to that feeling. One holds to the feeling. And now one is holding to the feeling and continuing to delight in that feeling. And it is this delight, this continuing delight in feelings, this is clinging. So now we move from craving to clinging. And now, with clinging as condition, there is bhava, being or existence. And then with being as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. And then sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. So this is the origin of the whole mass of suffering. And then the same block of text, this whole pattern is repeated for each of the sense bases together with its object. So we have the same thing with sound and the ear and so on, up to a mind object and the mind. So in this way, from paragraphs 26 through paragraph 30, we have the entire series, the 12-fold series of dependent origination, actually exemplified, or even we could say embodied, in terms of the concrete life experience of an individual. This is an individual whose mind is blinded by ignorance. It's somebody who abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished, with a limited mind, and somebody who doesn't understand as it actually is, that state of liberation where these unwholesome states cease without remainder. You see, all of that in these words at the beginning of paragraph 30, all of that is suggesting the presence of ignorance and non-development of mind. So one whose mind in that state is in that state will go on when such a person experiences these sensory objects, such a person will then again fall victim to this pattern of liking and disliking, favoring and opposing, craving and clinging. Okay, now having shown that, shown how the deluded ordinary person becomes entangled again and again in this bondage to his own experience. Now, in the next part of the sutta, which is given very concisely, the Buddha is going to show how a disciple becomes liberated. And so here the Buddha begins with this, citing how a Tathagata appears in the world. And in fact, I remember Venerable Analeo's notes on the Chinese counterpart of this sutta in the Agama version. In his notes, he explained that in the Agama version, this whole long passage on the Tathagata appearing in the world and all of the stages on the gradual training are not included, because here the Buddha is speaking to the monks who would have heard the sequence on the gradual training many times, so it wouldn't have been necessary for the Buddha to have developed it in relation to the monks. So probably in the Pali version, that text, which was given very concisely in the original, got elaborated in order to have a fuller presentation of the sutta. And so it would not really be necessary to go on with explaining all of those elementary stages of the training. But one could begin quite logically just by starting with the five hindrances, which are the obstacles to the development of the mind. And then one comes into the four jhanas. Those are the stages of meditative samadhi or concentration. And now, instead of going from the jhanas to the higher knowledges, to the vijas, you know, the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the arising or the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the taints or the asavas, the Buddha here is going to show how on the basis of the fourth jhana, a disciple will develop the understanding or insight into the sensory experience and use that understanding as a way to cut through the origination process of dependent origination. Okay, so now once the disciple has achieved the fourth jhana, now when such a person sees a form with the eye, then he doesn't lust after it if it's pleasing. He doesn't dislike it if it is displeasing, but he abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, a measureless mind, that is a mind which has been well developed. and he understands as it actually is the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom where those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Okay, that state of deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, where these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder, that would probably be the fruition attainment of arhantship, the complete state of the destruction of all the defilements. And now this disciple, even though he hasn't achieved that yet, but he knows that this is the state where all of these defilements cease completely. And so using that understanding as the basis, he's able to prevent the arising of liking and disliking for the pleasant and unpleasant sensory objects. And so whenever pleasant and unpleasant objects arise, he abandons favoring and opposing. That is, he doesn't favor or like pleasant sensory objects, and he doesn't oppose or dislike unpleasant or disagreeable sensory objects. And whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, or remain holding to it. Okay, so here, if we take the sequence on dependent origination, here we reach the point where we still have the six sense bases. Depending upon the six sense bases, there's still contact taking place. Depending upon the six sense bases, feeling is arising. Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. But when feeling arises, because there is correct understanding, right understanding, there's right development of mind and right understanding, and so one can use the development of mind and right understanding to cut through the chain of origination so that through the arising of feeling there will not occur tanha, there doesn't arise craving. And so one is breaking the chain of origination at that point where feeling feeds into the arising of craving. And basically there are two powers which enable a person to break that process of origination. This will differ from one person to another, and it depends on the relative strength in a person of samadhi and panya. Here in this sutta, a difference is not developed, but other suttas develop the difference. The two powers are the power of bhavana and patisankha, I think it's called. Okay, the power of, it's called bhavana bala, the power of development really implies the development of samadhi. And this is an approach used for those who have very strong or a natural facility, a natural ability in developing samadhi or concentration. So they are able to use the power of concentration to cut through the stage where feeling tends to give rise to craving. They'll draw their mind away from the pleasant feelings, the painful feelings. And by drawing back the mind through the power of samadhi, they'll prevent those overwhelming feelings, those very strong, pleasant and painful feelings, from triggering off reactions of craving for the pleasant feelings and aversion towards the painful feelings. Of course, the problem is that samadhi itself is not a final solution, and there can come subtle attachments to the pleasant feeling that arises through samadhi, and a subtle attachment to the peaceful, neutral feeling of samadhi. And so ultimately one needs the power of wisdom to break through the entire chain of dependent origination. But some people rely first upon the power of samadhi to cut away the grosser levels of origination, and then use the power of punya, wisdom, to cut off the subtle level of origination. Whereas other people, those who have a more dominant wisdom faculty, rely on the power of reflection or power of examination to draw the mind back from reacting to feelings with attachment to pleasant feelings, aversion towards the painful feelings. But even though a person might have started with punya, eventually for that punya to be able to cut through to deeper levels, it will eventually need the supporting base of samadhi. So on its own, the power of reflection can't dig very deep, but it's a useful starting point for a person whose faculty of punya is stronger than their faculty of concentration. So they'll begin with reflection, use reflection, say, on the unsatisfactory nature of sensory enjoyment, to draw the mind back from sensory entanglements, and then by developing a certain degree of equanimity through reflection, then they can develop a deeper samadhi, and then on that basis of samadhi, then they can cultivate panya or wisdom in a way that will become deeply penetrating into the nature of things. Okay, so having thus abandoned favoring and opposing, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he does not delight in that feeling or welcome it. Okay, this shows from the cessation of, actually feeling is occurring, but this shows here the cessation of craving. And then he does not remain holding to it. That shows the cessation of clinging. Okay, as he does not do so, delight in feeling ceases in him. With the cessation of his delight comes cessation of clinging. Okay, this restates the same thing. Okay, with the cessation of clinging comes cessation of being, or cessation of bhava, cessation of existence. With the cessation of existence comes, that's cessation of the karmically active, karmically creative side of existence. With the cessation of bhava comes cessation of birth. With cessation of birth comes cessation of aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, so we see that now the cessation side of the dependent origination is now being quite explicitly developed here. It's just unfolding from that living experience of this person. Okay, then the next paragraph just repeats the same text block, just to search and replace for I and forms to the other senses and their objects. And then we come to the conclusion. Here, again, we have to remember that the sutta started from a particular incident, which we might almost have forgotten by now. Yeah, it's true, because the incident was mentioned just at the very beginning of the sutta. But now the Buddha, in the very concluding words, he reminds us of the incident from which the sutta started. And here he gives his own title to the sutta, which is a way of emphasizing its importance. Often it's not common for the Buddha to do that, but now he's going to give a title to it. He says, "Bhikkhus, remember this that has been taught by me as the, what has been taught briefly by me as liberation, but deliverance in the destruction of craving. But remember Sati, the son of a fisherman, as caught up in a vast net of craving, in the trammel of craving." He uses two words almost synonymous for a net or web. The vast net of craving in the web of craving. So maybe before I ask the questions, maybe just should we do just a kind of very brief overview of the whole sutta, just to see any kind of pattern that we might have been lost through looking at in too fine detail at the parts. Okay, so coming back to the beginning. 349, page 349, we start with this incident where there's a monk named Sati who's been going around saying that he's been expounding his own so-called pernicious view, that he understands the Buddha's teaching to be that it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths. not another. He uses this expression, tang yeva vijnanam, this very same consciousness. Then the monks hear about this and they question Sati and they criticize him, try to convince him to give up that view, but Sati won't give up the view. Eventually they report him to the Buddha. The Buddha calls him up, then asks him, what he understands by consciousness. And then Sati says, here I'm on page 350, about the middle of the page. The Buddha says, what is that consciousness, Sati? And Sati says, Venerable Sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the result of good and bad actions. And then the Buddha rejects this, and the Buddha says that, have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness? And this we could perhaps say, this is the main theme of the sutta, that consciousness is dependently arisen and that there is always some condition for the arising of consciousness. Okay, then the first main section, expository section of the sutta, occurs in paragraph 8. This is called the conditionality of consciousness. And this shows how each of the six types of sensory consciousness arises in dependence on its own conditions. That is, each of the six types of sensory consciousness has as its condition a sense organ or sense base, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body and mind base, and the object condition, form, sound, smells, tastes, tactile objects and mental objects. Okay, then from consciousness, in paragraph 9, the discourse goes on to a wider theme in a rather somewhat obscure way with the question of this has come to be. And according to the commentary, this means the five aggregates as a whole. So here the Buddha is demonstrating that the five aggregates have come to be in dependence on nutriment. Nutriment are the strong conditions for the arising existence of the five aggregates. And then in paragraph 15, the Buddha continues this through by stating that there are four conditions or four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. Okay, so here the Buddha elaborates on the theme of nutriment. And then paragraph 16, he traces the conditions for these types of nutriments. And by doing so, he connects the teaching on the four kinds of nutriment to the teaching on dependent origination. And in this way, we start coming into the 12 links of dependent origination. But he picks up the chain of conditions midway through with craving and takes it back to ignorance. But then once he reaches ignorance, then he goes forward from ignorance all the ways forward to the normal end, to old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Okay, and so in this way we come to another way in which consciousness is shown to be dependently originated. One way is through, in terms of the way the six types of consciousness arise through their sense bases and sense objects. Here we see a more dynamic type of conditioning for consciousness in terms of its arising through the conditioning of the past, through ignorance and volitional formations, bringing consciousness into existence in this from life to life. Then we have various ways of exploring dependent origination in terms of arising, then in terms of cessation from page 356, 357, then lower part of 357, the emphasis on how this knowledge, this personal knowledge of dependent origination, brings the abandoning of doubt, the overcoming of doubts about whether we existed or not in the past, future, and present. And then that leads into this, we might call this exemplification of dependent origination through the process that I explained today, the process of organic birth and personal development of the ordinary individual who is still in the grip of ignorance and craving and continues on in the round of existence. That is on 358 to 359. And then to show the liberation from the round, we have the arising of a Buddha in the world, and then we have the person, the disciple, who learns the Buddha's teaching, overcomes the five hindrances, attains the jhanas, then restrains the senses and uses either concentration or insight not to give way to craving and aversion, but overcomes those reactions and thereby puts an end to the process of becoming and reaches the end of this mass of suffering. Okay, maybe at that point then I will stop and ask if there's any questions. Yes?
Going back to the concrete example?
Yeah.
Where the youth is growing up, and I followed it. It made sense right up until with clinging being.
Yeah.
So maybe provide an example. I was sort of thinking if he's craving some sort of sense desire and he wants a car, so.
Yeah.
And he gets the car and he clings to it. So does the being become sort of he's? I don't know. I can't put the words around it. Sort of taking that as an aspect of himself?
The way I would understand it, it's not really explained, it's not really explicated. It's just given, here and elsewhere in the form of this, almost like just a formula, a very concise formula. But the way I would understand it is, okay, there is a clinging, okay, delight in feelings is clinging. Okay, so it has a clinging to, one takes this delight in pleasant objects, and that is a clinging. Clinging to the objects. And with that clinging as condition, there is existence, being. What I would say is that, okay, that clinging as a condition, that clinging is a condition that ties one to the round of existence. So that clinging is what, by tying one to the round of existence, is what will bring one back into the round of existence for another rebirth. Or one could say that the clinging is a condition for the activities. This is using that distinction between the two types of bhava, the karmically active existence and the resultant existence. So with the clinging as a condition, okay, one sees the car, one wants the car, one has a clinging to this idea that one wants the car. But let us say, okay, the youth sees the car, he wants the car, he's craving the car. Then he engages in activities to purchase the car. Okay, he wants to get, he has to get a job, save money, by which time the car has gone out of style, so he's thinking about another car, which has become more stylish. But these activities now become the condition for him purchasing the car. Okay, now he gets the car, he becomes attached to this car, and we could say that this is determining him as his mode of being, as being the owner of that car. So dependent upon his clinging to that car, he is or in the mode of being the owner of the car. That is looking at it at one, a very practical this life level. But also, I think, in the way the Buddha intends it to be understood, it is through this, in a general sense, this clinging to pleasant feelings that we are constantly engaging in activities that generate the karma that bring us back to one state or another within the round of existence. So in that way, it's the clinging is a condition for the activities that generate karma that determine us to new existence in a particular form within this round of existence, the samsaric round of existence. That is the way I understand it.
Could you say, in essence, that this Gandhava, it sort of created a death?
That it's what?
The Gandhava?
Yeah.
Could you say that it sort of created a death? Or is, I know it's there at the beginning of life, is it also there at the end? Is that the beginning, the end to beginning?
It's not so much that it's created a death, but it seems to be a mode in which, or the vehicle through which the consciousness of the deceased person subsists in the state after the death in one existence until the conditions are suitable. So that's supposing the person is to be reborn in the human world again. So it's the vehicle through which that consciousness subsists until the conditions are suitable in the human world again, conditions are suitable for it to take rebirth again in the human world. My hypothesis would be that if a person passes away from the human world and is destined to take rebirth in the heavenly realm or in the hell realm, that they don't go into a Gandhava state, but that they would go, that they could take instantaneous rebirth from the human realm into a heavenly world or into a hell realm. Because there's no, I assume that there would be no need to wait for suitable karma conditions to appear there. One can just takes instantaneous rebirth there. And so as soon as one passes away, then one can take rebirth. But what would seem to me to be the case is that after one passes away as a human being, if one has the disposition, the proclivity to be reborn back in the human world, it seems very unlikely that at that very precise moment that one passes away, that there are the ideal conditions for a human rebirth again. The likelihood, the probability seems very, very small. So it would seem that the consciousness would have to remain in some form until the suitable conditions become manifest. And so the Gandhava would seem to be that form in which it remains. I read some passages last week that describe it as a kind, the person in that state or the being in that state still has a sense of the continuation of its identity with the identity of the person that passed away. There's not a change of the sense of identity. Sometimes a person isn't even aware that it has died. It's just that spatial distances can be crossed, long distances, almost instantaneously. There's not a very clear sense of the passage of time. And the person has a body, or they see themselves as having a body, but others don't see them as having a physical body. So there would seem to be some kind of form body there. But it's just, it's not a physical form within our realm of existence. Yeah, Peter.
Looking at, I guess, paragraph 30 and 40, I'm curious about this use of the word delight.
Yeah.
It seems to be in the place of where craving would be in the dependent imagination.
Yeah.
It's a Pali word there.
It's, the verb is abhinandati. And then the noun is nandi. Now, you see, when craving is described in this definition of the Second Noble Truth, Wado monks, is the Noble Truth of the origin of suffering.
This is the light here.
It's that craving, tatra tatra abhinandani, is craving which, I actually think the force of that word, the exact meaning should be, seeks delight here and there, rather than delights here and there. So it's the craving which seeks delight here and there. And I think it might be more exact to say not he delights in that feeling, but he seeks delight in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, delight arises in him. Then we could see more clearly a distinction between craving and clinging.
Right, it's kind of weird to say he delights in the feeling. As he does so, delight arises.
Yeah. That seems a little redundant.
Okay, so he seeks delight. And then in 40 it says, he does not seek delight in that feeling. As he does not do so, delight ceases.
David?
Human Gandhavas and animal Gandhavas, they would be together.
Human Gandhavas and animal Gandhavas?
There would be animal realm Gandhavas, wouldn't there?
I think so. It would seem logical to me that when an animal passes away, it should have a Gandhava also.
And they would be in the same kind of.
Floating around the same place. I'm not a special expert on the Gandhavas. I've seen it a few. Last week I read some passages from Gandhava about that. Some passages from people who have memories of having passed away, and they recollect their experiences in this intermediate state. It's from a book called Rebirth as Doctrine and Experience. But they were just a few paragraphs that wasn't like a detailed study of life between from one life to another, how I found my pet dog in the intermediate realm. Meeting old faithful, how to stock up with pet food and so I don't know. Yeah, George.
I wonder about the three realms, sense and form and formless. The sense sphere and the...
Yeah.
You talked about the Gandhava being within not the sense sphere, which I think of the four elements.
Yeah.
I wonder what is the form, why is it called the form sphere?
Okay, why is the form realm called the form realm? Well, you see, there's form, rupa, matter, form, both in the sense sphere realm and in the form realm. And so, you know, technically the existence of form is not a distinguishing feature of the form realm as apart from the sense sphere realm. But in the sense sphere realm, sense desire is said to be the strong motivating factor of beings in the sense sphere realm. And also in the sense sphere realm, we have grosser types of sensory experience. That is, we have sense, we have visual experience, auditory experience, smelling, tasting, touching. Okay, now the beings in the form realm, see, those are the realms that correspond to the attainment of the jhanas. So the beings in those realms don't have strong sense desires. So sense desire is not a strong motivating factor in those, for the beings in those realms. Because the basic, you call it the basic state of consciousness for the beings in those realms is the jhanic state of consciousness. Whereas the basic state of consciousness of the beings in our, in the sense sphere realm is a state of sense desire. Okay, so the beings in the form realm, they don't have the strong sensory desire. Though they do have sense desire, it does come up, but it won't take the form of sexual desire because there is not sexual differentiation there. They're all, well, unisex. There's just no sexual distinction. But they can have desire or craving for beautiful forms and sounds. According to the Abhidhamma, the Pali Abhidhamma, there is not smelling, tasting, and tactile sensations in those realms. But there is the visible experience, visual experience, and auditory experience, seeing and hearing there, because those are considered the subtler types of sensory experience. Okay, they have bodily forms, but those forms are very subtle and very...
Are they made up of matter, the four elements?
Yeah, their bodies are made up of matter, the four elements, but they are not within the same material dimensions of existence as we are. It's like as though, it's not like you could, we can travel through space so many thousands of light years and then we'll eventually reach their realms of existence. But they're working, they're living, their realms are existing at a different, I use the expression, vibrational frequency than our own. It's just a completely different realm of existence, so to speak. But their bodies, their world is made up of matter and the four elements. Yes.
Just looking at the start of paragraph 40, it seems somewhere within here is where awakening is happening, and I'm just trying to understand this a little closer. First it says he doesn't lust, he's just abided in the jhanas, cultivated the jhanas in 39, and now it says he doesn't lust after or dislike sensory experience.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that sentence as he doesn't lust after because he's abiding in the jhana and not because awakening is taking place.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because I also had wondered about that. The sutta doesn't show the attainment of a kind of insight, knowledge, or the realization of any kind of stage of awakening. But we have to understand that since he's speaking about definitely about the cessation of the round of existence, so we have to understand that those stages of awakening or realization have to be spliced in here at some point.
The way it seems, I guess tell me if this makes sense, is it seems the first part, not lusting or disliking, is because he's in jhana, and he's abiding mindfully.
No.
And then it says he understands...
No, it's not that he's abiding in jhana, because it says on seeing a form with the eye. Now, if one is in the jhana, then one is not seeing a form with the eye. One is not hearing sounds with the ears. And also he has some kind of, this person has some kind of realization or some kind of insight, some kind of realization with panya, with wisdom, not just the jhanic attainment, because he understands as it actually is that deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, where those evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Now that couldn't.
That was signifying the point of awakening. But you're saying he wouldn't even be seeing, sensing the form, so it must be happening before that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We just have to understand that it's taken place, but it's not shown in the sutta.
Okay,
I think we're going to have to stop now. Yeah, I will be away for 4 weeks, and then I come back on a Monday, but I'll need a little rest the day after I come back. So the next class will be March 21st. 14th, yeah, March 21st. And then the sutta that we're taking, somebody have their schedule with them? Chachaka, the six sixes. 148, that's good. Okay, so we'll end by sharing the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu.